If you are enjoying this podcast, why not try Baker Street 2033 by the same author, a metaphysical mystery involving Sherlock Holmes, virtual reality, and fictional objects. Available on Spotify, iTunes, and Amazon Music. The place was swarming with young punks. I caught up with Godwin just as he ended the crush. He was muttering to himself. Bloody embryos! All desperate to be anointed apostles, if only they knew. Above the din of drinks-made voices, I saw him make out the sound of a jazz piano and wince. That would have to stop. He sharp-elbowed his way through the crowd to the source of the atrocity. A cheap upright being crucified under the unkempt digits of a drunk student. Unless you want a little lead mixed in your martini, son, you best skedaddle. The pianist turned round. It was the same fella he'd helped in the street. You again? So you tinkle the ivories, huh? What time's your interview, kiddo? 12. I make it 10-2. Time for one or two lieder? You must know some Schubert. He was buying himself time. A leader, don't I? He stammered. Yes, one song. I know one song. Which one? Wanderer's Night Song, I think it's called. The question is still which one? Deutsche number 224 or 768?
He was wild, ferocious, impatient.
I thought you said you were a numbers guy. He was getting riled. English Mustard looked blankly back at him. This is the most famous of the two. He whistled the introduction to both, the piercing brilliance of sound that shocked the crowded bar into silence.
Unperturbed by the dropped jaws and glassy gazes turned his way, he was still trying to root out the answer.
Well?
English Mustard was as dumbstruck by this display as everyone else in the room. He nodded meekly. Off you go. English Mustard sat down before the keyboard, tall and gawky. He flexed his hands and mimed out the opening chords, turned to the whistler and nodded. The opening bars were a shambles, but he ignored this and struck up the vocal line on cue, not singing, whistling. It came out as pure birdsong, his eyes fixed on the pianist, the note slightly tremulous at the words that must have been scrolling through his head. I later clocked a translation. Nothing too fishy. Kind of pretty, even. You, who are from heaven, who assuage all grief and suffering, and fill him who is doubly wretched, doubly with delight. Ah, I am weary of striving. To what end is all this pain and joy? Sweet peace, enter my heart. By the end, his eyes, which seemed to pin the young pianist to his stool, had softened. The taut line of his mouth warped a little. He could almost be smiling.
Well, you mangled the ending, but never mind.
English Mustard was blushing.
I'm sorry.
Forget it. Perhaps we can try the other Nachtlied sometime.
He whistled the intro. It was then that the dame walked in. Sequined up to the eyeballs in lapis lazuli, sashaying through the crowd, bewitchment carved in ruby red all around her mouth.
Hot ziggity, it's Lan.
English Mustard looked up from his piano. She was swathed in a white feather boa and matching elbow-length gloves. Her bobbed hair looked like it had been carved out of black marble by Brancusi.
Perfect timing, as always. Godwit said it under his breath, but I still caught it. And I see she's brought the big boys with her. She was flanked by a couple of hoods. One was a human pipe cleaner with a halo of white hair. This hood was cut in a graceful walk behind the dame. The second was shorter and a little plumper with a neat sight parting. Both men were clean-shaven and doing their best to look sharp in three-piece suits. It might work for the locals, but it didn't impress me. These chumps had an idea of what a wise guy was supposed to look like and had gone out and bought the uniform. But something was missing. A certain color. Still, genuine wise guys or not, you could see they meant business, which meant trouble for someone. The question was, who? The three of them sat down at a table that had been kept for them by two other fellas, a couple of straight-up queens. Gunsels, I reckoned. A Victorian beard with glasses and a receding slickback who'd lifted Elgar's moustache. They were all over each other. The sound of champagne corks popping had me reaching for my gat. Ain't instinct a bitch. White Halo beckoned the kid at the piano over with a single bony finger. Then his eye fell on Godwit. A deranged smile did a little waltz across his lips. It was none too pretty. He elbowed his friends in the ribs and pointed Godwit's way. They looked at each other and spoke. Then both men reached into their inside jacket pocket. I was sure they were packing heat and got ready to hit the deck, but all they pulled out were bright pipes. They lit up and disappeared behind a blue-gray fog. "You best get over there, kid," said Godwin. English Mustard got up. "The tobacconist's the one who looks like a saint." English Mustard tried to thank him for his help, but Godwin just batted the gratitude away like a nuisance fly. As the gokey turned to leave, Godwin called after him. "You don't play too badly, kid. What's your name?"
"It's Tenpins."
And he was gone. The dame re-emerged on a small stage. The spotlight's golden hue was turning her into a Byzantine icon, one that was irreverent as hell and didn't give a damn. A new pianist had appeared out of nowhere and struck up a tune. Then the dame let fly. Everyone's eyes were on her, even the queen's. I had to admit, she had a lovely pair of pipes on her. Making whoopee. Why the hell not?
Another bride, another tune, another Sunday honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee.
Godwit didn't seem to like it. He stood there grimacing before spotting a vacant chair and sitting down opposite me. I tensed up and tried not to show it. I watched him gnawing his fingers and sliding round on his chair. A bad case of the fidgets. He caught my eye.
"How can anyone think listening to such caterwauling?"
he cried, his hands clasped to his head. He was like a pit bull terrier. Incessant. Ferocious.
"Who the bloody hell wants to listen to that? But perhaps that's the point, a paradox to join others that lot have found."
He gestured over to where the suits were sat with tenpins wreathed in pipe smoke.
"Russell said."
I felt like a dunce playing high stakes with philosopher kings. I wanted to keep him talking without singing any flat notes, so I kept it brief. "Sounds logical." He received a dry sort of laugh.
"Bertie's the one with the self-satisfied halo. His meek friend is Mr. Here Is One Hand."
He smiled grimly.
"If you want an emetic, there it is. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity."
His eyes went all wistful for a moment until he shook himself out of it.
"Do you know what the ass with the beard calls me behind my back?"
I shook my head.
"Herr Sinkelwinkel. There's English cosmopolitanism for you."
"Bunch of limeys," I sneered.
"I knew you were American." "No, ha, that's a laugh. What do I know? I don't suppose you read detective magazines, do you? Street and Smith?"
Was this guy for real? Was I being pumped? Not my cup of tea, I'm afraid.
"Shame. You should try Norbert Davis.
Rendezvous with Fear. It's the good stuff.
A flourish of cobalt sparkles sashayed into view.
Mind if I join you, fellas?
End notes. The story of the Cambridge Apostles comprises a long, entangled history of masculine genius, platonic and homoerotic love, spirings, and prestigious positions in public life. The Apostles is a society of Cambridge intelligentsia first founded in 1820 and originally called the Cambridge Conversazione Society. The name Apostles derives from the 12 founding members who met to discuss metaphysical questions. As with any secret society, there are somewhat ludicrous rigmarole for being admitted to its precocious bosom. For instance, in Wittgenstein's day, membership was an arcane process of being nominated and elected unanimously by existing members in secret. Only successful candidates became aware they were members. During Wittgenstein's tenure at Cambridge, when he was under the wing of leading apostle and philosopher of mathematics Bertrand Russell, he was inveigled into this viper's nest of pseudo-intellectual posturing and its occult practices. The fat, leather-bound tome known as The Book, in which minutes of meetings were kept, such titillating moral debates as Why Laugh? Answer, Why Not? The stowing away of the book in a wooden chest, the Ark, which had been designed especially for this ritualistic purpose. Many of soi-disant greats of 20th century British public life were members, including the aforementioned Russell, the economist John Maynard Keynes, philosopher G.E. Moore, and writer and critic Lytton Strachey. The Schubert Lieder is interesting. Monk informs us that he used to whistle them while Pinsent played the piano. The philosopher Kings is a clever and wry twinning of Plato and his Cambridge contemporaries, Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore. Both receive disparaging thumbnail sketches here. Indeed, the references in this chapter reveal the emergence of a more waspish tone, one that cavils at the academic intrigues and incestuous nature of Cambridge life. Is Wittgenstein here attempting to purge a latent bitterness or resentment about his treatment there? There has been much speculation over precisely which issues of Street & Smith's Detective Story magazine Wittgenstein actually read that summer. Horace Murgatroyd of Princeton's philosophy department has long believed it to be the April issue. In a paper in 2004 for the Wittgensteinian, he claimed to have performed a qualitative corpus analysis of the extant letters from 29 April 1948 through to August, when the philosopher moved to Dublin, and found word patterns commensurate with the influence of stories featured in the April issue. This has been ferociously disputed by Cowper, 2005, Macanto, 2006, and Fruchberger, 2010, among others. My own preference is for the July issue for the following reasons. In the late 1940s, Street & Smith's Detective Story magazine front covers were moving away from the usual vivid hand-drawn illustrations, the terrified blondes and gun-toting hoodlums in trilbies and raincoats, branching out into a more abstract aesthetic. By 1947, Salvador Dali's surrealism is visible in a disembodied female head lying beside train tracks in the desert. An artist's articulated wooden mannequin lies across the tracks, which trail off into a vanishing point between a pyramid and the Sphinx. Another issue from that year shows a willow tree in silhouette shedding playing cards instead of leaves. The covers from early 1948 maintain this surrealism, but by the spring, the influence of the avant-garde and the geometric shapes of painters such as Kazimir Malevich emerges. Given that Wittgenstein complained about hearing machinery even in his beloved Brahms' music, would Malcolm have risked igniting his ire by sending in magazines flaunting such modernist touches? Wittgenstein was in the Rosrow Cottage from May to August 1948, but this needn't mean contemporaneous issues of Street & Smith weren't sent to him. It could be that Malcolm sent a whole pile, as he sometimes did to Cambridge, although Wittgenstein had responded to one such glut that one magazine a month is ample. Any more prevented him from doing philosophy. The contents pages of these magazines reveal the potboiler nature of this hard-boiled fiction. Death is omnipresent. The unlamented corpse. Murder plays Cupid. Dead men in white. In the January 1948 issue, Death not only takes a bow and wears feathers, he also reveals his hands and possesses a bright angel in four separate stories. And yet, it is precisely the death-saturated atmosphere of the July issue that I find so persuasive a fit. Its cover harking back to the illustrative tropes of yore in an almost postmodern way. See figure 1. Generic elements are dotted across an inky plane that is segmented by white lines of perspective. A wind-warped tree, a gravestone, a shovel. The gloom is broken up by a couple of huge pink and yellow roses which take centre stage, as it were. Looking at it now, the elements all link up. The roses appear to have been lain on the grave that has been freshly dug beneath the tree. The stories listed on the cover reflect this morbidity. In case of death, already buried, specialists in death. Isn't the philosopher noir author a philosopher detective solving his own murder whilst digging his own grave in this text? Regardless of Murgatroyd's repeated assertions for April, one can almost imagine Wittgenstein's copy of the July Street and Smith wearing his fingerprints like white tattoos, the live smudges of a heavy rotation of readings. But why detective story magazines and their hard-boiled fiction? As hitherto mentioned, there are pertinent parallels between philosophy and detective work so that we might begin to speak of a philosophy of detection. One need only ponder its particular methodology of investigation, the piecemeal accumulation of clues, evidence, intuitions, the long hours grind of stakeouts and shadowing tales through city streets, the interrogations and second guessing, and using all this information to forge a map that leads to the solution, to find ample correspondences. Wittgenstein wrote of the grain of wisdom that could be found in detective stories, and which was sorely lacking from the articles in the academic philosophical journal Mind. Dear Old Blood, Notes on a Wittgenstein Noir will return in Episode 4, A Bloody Curious Bird is My Problem. If you have enjoyed this podcast, you might like to consider others by the same writer and producer, such as Baker Street 2033 and Modern Gothic. All are available from the usual podcast outlets. You could also consider supporting the writer at buymeacoffee.com/Neil Fitzgerald.